Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 145 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Joining us this episode is Teresa Carl Sanders, author of the Outlander Kitchen Companion Cookbook. Welcome!
Hello! Hello, ladies. Thank you for having me.
Now, we've interviewed Teresa before on our show, and it was actually episode 16, back when we were a wee baby podcast. Episode 16 is called Outlander Kitchen and Claire's Gizzard. And if you want to know what that has to do with Claire's Gizzard, you'll have to go back and listen. But for those who don't know about you, Teresa, how did you find the Outlander books, and how did Outlander Kitchen come into being?
I actually had an everyday 9-to-5 good job in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia, that really didn't do anything for me or for my soul. And I literally just had enough one day and quit with the support of my husband. And after my 2 weeks' notice was up, I was in a bookstore one day, and I was looking for something really good to read. And I was wandering the shelves with nothing in my head, really. I didn't have an idea of what I wanted to read, and I came across a red cover with a gold clock. That was a long time ago. That was 2001. And that was the cover of Outlander, the soft cover of Outlander. And I found Jamie and Claire then. And I read myself silly all the way through until the end of The Fiery Cross, which was the last book at the time. And then I had to wait about 6 months for A Breath of Snow and Ashes. So those Outlander fans that are adept at waiting for the next book will know that 6 months is nothing. And then after that, I think it was 3 or 4 years, and then it was another 5 years for the next book. So it's been a long journey, and Outlander Kitchen started in 2010. And it started after a long walk in the woods with my dog. I now live on a small island just off the coast of Vancouver, and it's called Pender Island. And we were in the woods walking, and funnily enough, pigeon rolls with truffles came up in my head. They popped into my head, and that's from Voyager, right after Jamie and Claire get back together, and they're in Madame Jean's, and that's what they have one night. And by the time I got home, I had the recipe half written in my head, and I had an interview that was food-related that I sent off to Diana's Canadian publicist, and Diana responded very generously the next day, and that was the birth of Outlander Kitchen, and it started in 2010, and then I started the blog in 2011. And that brings us
to today.
Yeah. and then the TV series came along, and a whole bunch of other really, really fun stuff came along. And then one day I got a call asking if I wanted to make a cookbook. And so I signed the contract for that cookbook last May. So I bet if we looked at the calendar or I looked at the contract, I bet it would be very close to today, actually, a year ago today.
So basically what you're saying is since 2010, you've been slacking.
I have been slacking. I'm one of those internet memes, you know, what people think you do and what you actually do. And what my mother thinks I do is very, very different. But I've been working really, really hard on it for 5 years. I mean, 5 years I've been gestating this baby. So we were talking about just before we started recording about having a baby and giving birth to it. And I feel I'm not a mother, so I'm not comparing it to motherhood. I don't want anyone to get mad at me, but it is for me the closest all I'll probably ever come to giving birth to a baby. And it's been a long, long journey that has been a lot of fun and really rewarding. And I'm so excited for everybody to see the book.
That's like close to an elephant gestation.
I think elephants are 2 years.
Is it two? It's either two or three.
It's long. It's not five.
It's not, I mean, it's no 9 months. I mean, 9 months feels like an eternity.
Whales are long too.
Well, whales are long too. General. Yeah.
Does gestation period just get longer the larger the animal is? I mean, is that kind of a...
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me.
This is a weird segue. Sorry.
I think you need Outlander anatomy. They would at least be able to answer the question better than me.
That is true. Okay, so we have, thanks to some little elves, we have in our hot little hands a copy of your beautiful book. And one of the first questions that, okay, the first thing that anyone sees, especially if they're not necessarily looking for that book, they're just looking at a shelf of books, if they're facing out toward them, is the cover, of course. What can you tell us about the cover? And does the red dress on the cover, is it supposed to be somewhat evocative of Claire's dress? Of course, the style is completely different. Was that intentional, or what was the story behind the cover?
It's not meant to be evocative of Claire's red dress from Dragonfly and Amber, but it certainly is good timing, and we could claim that it is.
Totally, that's what you meant.
I've learned a lot about covers and things like that, and the one thing I will say is that I've been told that red stimulates appetite. So that's why McDonald's and Wendy's, quite a few of them use red in their logo a lot. And the dress kind of draws you in. It's a bit late for, it's not really a 17th century or an 18th century dress, because the silhouette of an 18th century dress was too pillowy. So it didn't sort of, it didn't allow us to focus in on the food. And this shot was taken by the photographer of all the big photos in the book, Rebecca Wellman, who lives in Victoria, just about a 45-minute ferry ride away from me. And she took, I would say, six different shots, like six different days, went out to the same park with this poor model woman and her basket of tarts, and tried different things and tried different dresses. And this is actually a replica dress that they bought online. But it actually works the best, and it works really, really well with those Fraser strawberry tarts and with the plaid napkin. I just love it. I think it's a really beautiful cover. I don't get tired of looking at it, and I know it's going to catch, as you say, a lot of people's attention in the bookstore when they're not really even looking, or they don't even know what they're looking for.
Well, from the word Outlander at the very top, and I noticed the font of the letters Outlander Kitchen is very reminiscent of a Starz Outlander font. So
yes.
there's a lot of,
definitely,
I guess,
in the family.
Yeah. So it's very, very serifed. The name is going to, of course, catch people's attention. The color will. And so when you mentioned that red simulates appetite, so basically you want us all to get fat.
Yeah. And that's why they put a slim woman on the cover.
Thanks a lot.
That is not me on the cover. Let's just make that very clear. That is actually Rebecca's sister-in-law, who braved the elements of the Pacific Northwest in failing fall. It was getting closer and closer to October and November, and she went out there a few days when it wasn't a very nice day. So in a thin dress. So thank you to both of them, because it really is a beautiful cover.
So how did you, Sophie's Choice, choose that cover recipe?
How did you sew?
That was
That's a good question.
It's a bit of a Sophie's Choice. No, actually, the author has very little control over the cover of a book. So I've really lucked out here. The publisher had an idea of what they wanted the cover to look like, and it was quite radically different from what Rebecca had sort of envisioned in her head. So Rebecca went to a theatrical company and borrowed an 18th century dress from them and quickly threw this sort of prototype photo together to get the publisher's attention and approval, and they really loved it. It's a really great cookbook cover. Then, basically, we didn't have any other choice but those Fraser strawberry tarts in the end. That's the recipe that Rebecca first chose. It's great because it's got the strawberry on the cover, and it's actually a really easy, doable recipe. It only takes about, well, let's say 45 minutes from beginning to end, but that's really beginning to very end, and you're eating tarts in the last 5 minutes.
That's my favorite 5 minutes.
The eating part.
And you can actually, you can totally cheat. You could buy frozen pastry shells and bake them and fill them with jam and be eating in like 15 minutes. So it's a very doable recipe, which is sort of a theme throughout the book. There's some hard recipes, but there's a lot of them I tried to keep doable and in a time frame that most of us have to cook these days. Most of us don't have 8 hours in the kitchen. So, and Rebecca ran with the strawberries, and I think she did such a great thing there. They're really, they're much more beautiful than the tarts I made the first time I made them. So,
now, did I see online you have business cards with this image on them as well?
Yes, business cards, thinking about getting some aprons done.
Oh. Yep. Yeah. I'm just imagining an apron.
I know. Every time I say an apron, everybody's like, yeah, apron.
No, I'm just imagining
it would
wearing...
be a very, not thinning, what's the word?
Slimming?
Slip, thank you.
No, but
it would be a very slimming apron.
But it would have to go like around your neck, but it would have to make it look like you were wearing that red dress and holding the tarts in front.
Totally, and then you can buy that. I don't know if you've ever seen the novelty apron on Amazon with the kilted man, with the strong kilted man. So you could have actually the Outlander Kitchen female apron and then the strong bare-chested kilted man apron. If you haven't checked it out, it's really, really funny. It's a great gag gift. It's only about $10.
I've seen the towels. Have you seen the towels?
Yes, I actually have a towel in my house. It's not my towel, and I didn't buy it.
You just picked it up at some
But I do have a blue version of that towel in a drawer somewhere.
Your dedication is to your husband, and you write, "To Howard, my Englishman, you look and sound a lot like Frank, but your heart and love is pure Jamie." Now tell us about, because obviously this book is your 100% from you, but as any creation, whether it's an actual human child or something like this, participation by others is to varying degrees. He may not have like written anything, but how important was he in your being able to produce this?
Oh, he's everything to me, but he's everything to Outlander Kitchen too. And he's a taste tester and he's a bottle washer, but he's really my number one supporter. And he's been very, very patient. It's been, as we've said, a long project, and he's sort of kept us afloat through that whole time because I haven't had a paying job for most of it. And he's believed in the project the whole time, even when things looked bad a few years ago. And then now he's a cheerleader. I mean, now we just have fun because something good happens every day right now. So that's really, really exciting.
And will he get to travel with you when you go on your some of your book tour?
There are some destinations that he is a must. He's signed up for and he's demanding to go to. and so they would be Scotland, anywhere sort of exotic and nice. But we're not really doing a book tour. So I've got a few stops around North America, but most of them are sort of gathering, like large Outlander gatherings. And Howard's dream is to dress up as Black Jack Randall and stand behind me and look menacingly at everybody at a signing. But I don't know if the Outlander world is ready for Howard to be Black Jack Randall.
Oh, are you kidding me? Have you never... Well, I don't expect you because I know you're very busy. I'm not hurt if you've never listened to any episode where I've said this, but I'm all about the BJR. I have a thing for Tobias. So if your husband is going to dress up like BJR, I say do it.
Well, and he could maybe put on, you know, a sweater with some elbow patches and be Frank too.
He's
English, so he sort of really does sound exactly like Frank. Tobias is Frank. He's got the same.
So maybe you better not take him with you.
Well, you never know what's going to happen, you know, with all those crazy ladies.
Exactly.
I promise you, every one of those events is going to be full of Anglophiles who are in love with accents. So I'm just...
Yeah, well, and I have to say that was part of his appeal initially 21 years ago. So I can't complain.
So while he'll be standing menacingly behind you, you'll be standing or sitting menacingly in front of him, warding the women off.
Hey, it sounds a little bit like Jamie and Claire too, doesn't it?
So, yeah, it actually does. So after the dedication in your foreword, when I read, "Food disappears all the time," I dissolved into fits of giggles. All right, so amazing that Diana wrote the foreword and is beautifully done and tells the story, really, of this book. Now, what was it like when you either found out that she was going to write it or did you approach her to write it?
Yeah, I asked her very early on, I think before we even signed the contract with the publisher, it's part of the contract with the publisher that Diana would write the foreword because Diana is Outlander. And it would be, I can't imagine having anyone else write it. And she's been really supportive all the way along. And of course said yes right away because that's what she always says. So it's a beautiful foreword and it makes me smile and it's very complimentary and it tells the genesis of Outlander Kitchen and how she and I first started communicating about the idea and why it took so long. And yeah, it just explains it really, really well. And that's exactly what a foreword is supposed to do, which is, of course, exactly what you expect from Diana. She knows exactly what it is, what the definition of it is, and she delivers completely.
That she does. That she does. As far as the organization of your cookbook, you gently introduce what I termed the reader eater, to your Outlander kitchen. So you talk about what some of the staples are for the pantry, for prepping to enter this world of the Outlander kitchen. How did you decide to include that? Because sometimes, although there's typically in cookbooks, you're going to have information before the actual recipes start. How did you decide how much detail to go into when you were sitting down to tell people about the basics?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good question. I'm never heavy-handed. I try not to be, as a writer, heavy-handed with information because I think it just gets bogged down and nobody really reads it. And especially these days, you have to be kind of punchy and short with information. So, like, for the pantry section, as I was writing the recipes, there aren't very many hard-to-find ingredients, but there are a few. So I was jotting those down and making mental notes about what I would talk about there and trying not to use really rare or hard-to-find ingredients once. Like, I try to use them at least a couple of times in the cookbook so you don't get stuck with a bunch of things on your shelves that you're never going to use again. And then when we talk about prepping and knife skills and things like that, Mrs. Bug, of course, would have been using her knife, and it would have been a pretty... It wouldn't have been a chef's knife, let's just say that. It would have been closer to a dirk. Modern chef skills are really important. You know, if you can take a knife skill class, that's probably the most important thing you can do to make things in the kitchen easier for yourself, just because then you're safer with it, and you know how to keep it sharp, and you know how to cut things. So I go through some basic cuts that not everybody knows, but they're basic cuts that I learned in culinary school, and I still use every day. And then I guess the last thing is, I try and explain why I'm using, in some recipes, stand mixers and Cuisinarts when they're very anachronistic in terms of 18th century cuisine. But let's get real. Mrs. Fitz certainly had at least a dozen kitchen maids, and I don't have any, and I use my KitchenAid. So that's my explanation, and I'm sticking with it.
You've just replaced the kitchen maids with your KitchenAid.
Yes, I did. And my... I explain in the book that my KitchenAid is a lot better kept and a lot cleaner than a scullery maid. So in the grand scheme of things, you're probably safer with a KitchenAid.
So you mentioned your photographer, Rebecca Wellman, but she's also a cook and as well as food stylist, not just a photographer.
Yeah, she makes her money photographing food, but she's an amazing cook and stylist.
Now, what was it like working with a food photographer, if that's the right term?
Yes, it is. A typical relationship with a food photographer and there's a food photographer, and then there's a food stylist, and then there's the cookbook author or the cook. So you can actually have three people involved in one photo. Most of the time, the cook or the photographer are doing the styling, so there's only two of you. Rebecca and I both decided early on we really get along. We're very similar people, and we sort of looked each other in the eye and frankly said, I work better alone. And she was very happy, and I couldn't believe the results we got in the first couple of recipes she did, and she started sending back some proofs. The photos were just amazing, and the styling was beautiful, and she's obviously an accomplished cook. So I just let her at it. There's a couple of dishes in there that we were running out of time, and she had to take photos sort of quickly. So I made the tortellini and then froze it and took it over on the ferry, and she made the sauce and put it all together. And there were a couple, and I think the turtle soup I made as well. But other than that, every photograph she took, she made, she styled, and I'm really in awe of her. She's a very talented person.
Something I found interesting is that, and this is Ginger, as a vegetarian, now I'm not a vegan, I appreciated just how many of your recipes that I could enjoy. Now, I counted about 69. Now, that's including a vegetarian section, all drinks, desserts, breads, etc. But the number is even higher if you consider making substitutions or leaving out meat or other ingredients. Although, of course, if it's a main dish like spare ribs or something, obviously that's not going to work.
It's hard to leave the roast beef out of the roast beef.
Exactly.
Yeah, but bacon. There's a few dishes with bacon that are easy to leave out.
Why would you want to? It's so delicious.
Know. Bacon is like a crack. Did you go into it with a mind of, okay, yes, it's Outlander based, it's Outlander themed, but I do want to appeal to, you know, as many people as possible, because there are a lot of, most people do eat meat or some kind of animal flesh, if you will. So what was your thinking going in there?
Well, it's a 21st century cookbook. So although we're talking about, most of the time we're talking about 18th century food, you really don't want to eat 18th century food in the 21st century every day. Like, trust me, ask Howard, we've done it. And we're way different. Our palates are way different. And we've got a lot of alternative diets going on right now with, you know, low carb and gluten free and a lot of vegetarians and a lot of vegans. And I had a lot of people over the last 5 years. I've been talking to a lot of different Outlanders. And so I have a pretty good idea of what people cook and how they cook and what they want to cook. And I think it's important to have, if I want people to use the cookbook every day, which I do, I want it on your kitchen counter. I don't want it in your living room above the fireplace, right? I want it on the kitchen counter. I want it to be stained and I want it to be used, because these are old time recipes that I've updated, sometimes just to make them easier in the 21st century or to make them more adaptable to your lifestyle. So if you're meat free, then there's lots of opportunity to still eat Outlander without compromising. And it's fun, right? It should be fun. Eating should be fun. Reading is fun. Eating what you read is even more fun. Hey, I just made up a whole new logo. It's really cheesy, but there you go.
One of the first recipes that I did of yours, and I did this was a while ago. This was before the cookbook was official. I think you had the recipe on either your blog or I saw it on Facebook, one of the two. But I did your shepherd's pie.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that.
And I had messaged you because I was like, I don't do potatoes because I'm trying to do the low-carb thing. And I was like, do you have any recommendations? And you recommended cauliflower, which I'm in love with cauliflower. I think you can almost replace anything that has a potato in it with cauliflower at this point. But that was the most amazing thing I've ever eaten. And it was probably, I don't think I've put that much effort into cooking a dish in a very long time, because I had to, I bought everything and I chopped everything and I like cooked it in my pan and then I put it in the pan and put it in the oven. Like I put some serious time into that dish and it was so worth it.
That's another reason why it tasted so good, right?
Absolutely.
Because you did. I mean, you worked for that meal, man. And then you worked for the leftovers too.
Oh, I did.
I really like that recipe. It's really, really good. It's not Mrs. Bug's shepherd's pie. It's an example of being a classic that I've updated with red wine and Parmesan cheese, which, you know, hey, probably wouldn't have been in the Highlands, or it probably wouldn't have been in the backwoods of North Carolina. But it tastes really good, and you get to read the excerpt before you make the recipe, and you get to make a recipe from scratch, from whole food, and it just tastes so much better, I think, than a quick and easy, you know, whatever they have now, like reheatable roast beef or whatever it is that they have now in the store. I live in a really small island with a really small grocery store, so we don't see those things. But Whole Foods is where it's at, man.
And I think she was six at the time. My six-year-old ate it without complaint, didn't question it. I put it down in front of her, and I said, this is dinner, and she ate it and never once complained. And that, when introducing new foods to six-year-olds, that in and of itself is high praise.
Hey, well, I will take it then. That's great. I know kids can be picky eaters, but I'm glad she liked it.
So speaking of the shepherd's pie, the names, as an example of a recipe, the names of your recipes are awesome. From things that are paired nicely, for example, hot broth at Castle Leek and Mrs. Bug's cinnamon toast, to others that are more tongue-in-cheek. Stephen Bonnet's salted chocolate pretzel balls, Black Jack Randall's dark chocolate lavender fudge, and my not so favorite, almond squirts.
Almond squirts, I know.
I know. Can barely say
what
that.
Do I say? I actually say something in the intro to the recipe, like the tasty cookie with the unfortunate name. It's just, yeah, I know. I wonder how many people will actually make them. They're actually really good.
Now I have to make them, like, I'll make them.
The visual, though, is just, it doesn't help, does it? So.
You won't forget them. You won't forget them. And some of your recipe titles touch our book reader hearts. And that would be, for example, things like Myrta's Gift to Ellen, Jenny's Onion Tart, Roger and Bree's Pizza. That one, I love that one. Dumplings in Cross Creek, Warm Almond Pastry with Father Anselm, and Jem's Bread Pudding with Maple Butterscotch Sauce. So just when you pair, I mean, it's pretty easy. Like, pretty much the one thing they all have in common was character names. So when I hear that, it puts you either in a book or in a place or in a, even if it's not from an actual scene, it brings a character to your heart and mind. And it's, man, it's so touching. Did you find yourself really thinking about a character and wanting to have something for that character or associated with him or her? Or did you have a recipe that you really wanted to include and that you linked it with someone?
A little bit of both. A little bit of both. The character-inspired recipes just sort of started, and I can't remember which one the first one was. Murtaugh's Gift to Ellen was certainly one of the first, and I remember how Stephen Bonnet's Salted Chocolate Pretzel Balls started. That was a naughty Facebook conversation late at night. And I was making pretzel balls at the time, and somehow Stephen Bonnet got wrapped up into it, and it took off. And I mean, it's a really tasty recipe, but when you give them to people and you tell them what they are, everybody has a good laugh. So, and then after that, once I had like a really good long list of character inspired recipes, and then added ones like Jenny's Onion Tart. I mean, Jenny's Onion Tart takes place in Voyager when Claire follows Jenny out to find out why she's brought leg hair. Leary back to, I drew a blank for a minute, why she brought Leary back to Lollybrock. And that's a really emotional scene, and that has to be in there. And it's also probably one of my favorite recipes in the whole book. It's a classic. It was taught to me by a French chef who's very dear to me, and I've removed the bacon from his recipe to make it vegetarian, and I know somewhere, although he doesn't know, he would curse me if he knew. And then after that, then there were some characters that you didn't sort of immediately associate with food, but you couldn't have them missing. So you certainly couldn't have, like, Old Ian missing. And I was looking through a book of old Scottish recipes one day, and I came across buttered leeks. And butter, I mean, leeks, there isn't much more Scottish vegetable than a leek. And buttered leeks are a classic, and they're a really good solid side dish. And Ian is a good solid sidekick for Jamie, and he's the kind of guy you always want on your right-hand side, defending you, just like you want buttered leeks beside your roast chicken. You see where I'm going? So some of them are a stretch. Some of them are a stretch. But when you read the excerpt, generally, I mean, Diana always has an emotion. There's always something there that I can draw from, right? I have a huge canvas of things, of excerpts that I can pick from. And so I generally have one that matches really well. And if it doesn't work, then I toss the recipe and we start over again. And I have done that quite a few times in the last few years.
Now, Summer mentioned that when she cooked the shepherd's pie, and some of the recipes, or two of the recipes I've tried, were one that I made and one that you made. I made Black Jack Randall's dark chocolate lavender fudge, I think in 2014 when we had you on, or maybe 2013, but it was when we had you on the first time. And yeah. I made it so that we could talk about it. And of course, I tried it. It was delicious and sinful, but very good. And then the next thing I tried of yours, I think it was in June 2014 at that Seattle event when yeah. you had Stephen Bonnet's salted chocolate pretzel balls you were walking around with because they had to be like really cold. And I remember you saying that, you know, you hope that they lasted.
Yes, that's right. I had them in a freezer. I brought all these tiny little balls, I think probably 10 or 12 dozen of them, and I packed them in a freezer pack, and I carried them on the ferry, and it's like a four-hour ride down to Seattle from where I am. And by the time I got there, actually, they were a little soft. Talk about man balls. But they froze up quite nicely, and we actually ended up baking them the next day and handing them out in line, so...
Oh, they were delicious.
The things you do when you travel. Was I even supposed to have raw balls crossing the border? I don't know. I didn't ask.
Is there a raw ball restriction?
There. I doubt there would be a problem, but some things are restricted and you just can't do it, right? Mm-hmm. And uncooked food is always catches their eye, we shall say.
Usually fruits and vegetables are the worst.
Exactly. I can't imagine there'd be a problem, but hey. I had someone stop me with my cumin seeds one day. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
he didn't like the look of my
nasty cumin seeds.
It's like, is that weed? Are you planning on growing weed, well, dude, ma'am?
If you'd asked me that, I would have said, wow, dude, you don't get out very much. But no, He confiscated my cumin seeds, so there you go.
Shameful.
I know.
So one of the things that I discovered while reading your book was coddled eggs. I'd never heard of this before, and the title actually was almost a little off-putting, because when you think of things being coddled, it's usually not a good thing. But when I read it more, I realized that it was more than just like congealed food. It was basically how you could eat like a soft-boiled egg without having it in its shell. I've tried to make soft-boiled eggs in the past in the shell, and I've never succeeded at being able to like just crack the top off and be able to eat the egg out of it. But I was so intrigued by this recipe that I actually had to go find a coddler. I did. And afterwards I read the rest of the paragraph that said that I could have used a mason jar, which I have so many mason jars around my house. But now I have egg coddlers and they're really cute.
Coddlers are cool.
They're so cute. Like I have a little one. It's like got little dots all over it, like raised dots all around it. And it's like white porcelain and it's got a little screw top. It's super cute.
Maybe I'll have ginger. That sounds like the ones I grew up with. Yeah.
Oh, yes. They're super cute. And what was so crazy about this recipe is it's not really a recipe. It's just like, hey, crack some eggs in it. Add what you want.
And it's a method.
Exactly. And it was a new method that I love, and I don't want to have an egg any other way now.
Oh, hey, awesome. I love them, too. I grew up with my dad loved coddled eggs. But he would always undercook them, and they were kind of gross because he liked undercooked eggs. But now that I'm in control of my coddled egg, we have one at least once a week because they're so good, and they're so comforting, and you get toast soldiers, and you dip them in, and it's just like being a kid.
Yeah, no, they're delightful, and they're silky, and they're not rubbery. And
everybody that hates egg yolk is totally retching right now.
I know. But even the whites, like the egg white itself is silky and like not rubbery, because I've had like,
but also not runny.
No, it's not runny. They're firm. I mean if you cook you'll cook them long enough, but my whites are firm and my yolk is warm.
Is warm. Yes. I've had actually more couple of people sort of use their outside voice on Facebook on an Outlander Kitchen post with that particular picture. They don't like the yolk. And it's a big old yucky yuck yuck from them. It's a funny thing. Eggs are funny. If you don't like them, you really don't like them. Like you can't stand even looking at them.
Well, we have fun with that one. My daughter, I got two coddlers. So when we do breakfast, I will let my daughter do her own. So we'll put the eggs in it, and then she adds her own ingredients, and then we put them in the boiling water. And she, it's kind of like, you know, build your own pizza, but it's build your own coddled eggs. So,
well, that's so much fun. And you know, to be honest, that's exactly how my interest in food got sparked. Is my dad and I stood at the counter and made those eggs together, and we did, and I stood at the counter and made biscuits with my grandmother and all that kind of thing, and that's totally how you build food and a love of cooking, because not everybody likes cooking, but I think sometimes these days it's because we don't always get a chance to do it as kids anymore because times have changed and people are running out the door and there's not as much time. But I love and cherish all of those memories I have of standing at the kitchen counter with whoever it was and baking or making.
I do have some memories making or baking, but that was not really our childhood. Our lovely dad would, let's just say we had some set meals, and one of them was pasta, which is fine.
Yeah.
Pasta's good. And what were some other ones? We got spaghetti a lot.
We got some really roughly broiled chicken.
Oh, I don't even, okay.
Like, it was gone. Like, it was cremated chicken and
TV dinners.
TV dinners. They did, you know, we survived. And actually, I think that the fact that that's the food that we were fed a lot of growing up sparked my interest in it. And I started cooking just on my own with like recipe books and stuff probably when I was 12 or 13. So, I mean, everyone comes to it in their own way. I think you either have it and you are interested in it or you're not.
Totally. There's a lot of people that aren't. But I hope Outlander Kitchen touches people that maybe don't know that they really do love it and gets them into the kitchen for one afternoon having fun with a beloved character or whatever. I love cooking and I get a lot of pleasure from it. And I really, really hope that comes across in the book.
And I think you said the key part is it's not just, there are a few hooks, right? This is the Outlander Kitchen companion cookbook, but it's, once you open it, there you can be hooked by a delicious recipe, something that looks good, or by a picture that looks good, something that sounds good, or by an ingredient, if you look up an ingredient, or a character name. So there are so many things that could hook someone.
Oh, well, thanks. That's a really nice way of looking at it. Yeah, I think so. I think it's not just for cooks. You know, I say I want it on the kitchen counter, but hey, if you want to sit in the living room in front of the fire and cozy up with La Dame Blanche's hot chocolate and never cook another thing out of that book, but just enjoy it, because it does have so many beautiful excerpts from Diana and the pictures are glorious, you could sit and just enjoy it.
I know what they have to do. They have to buy two copies. One to keep clean and nice and pretty and look at in the living room or in bed. I don't care. Whatever. It's all your business. But one to keep in the kitchen or near your cooking place.
Because yeah.
It's going to get splashed.
You know, I'm starting to get used to cooking off my iPad or my tablet. And there's a Kindle version too, right? You can now download the Kindle app or whatever, Nook app or whatever, to your iPad and use it. And it's actually, once you get used to having your iPad or tablet in the kitchen, it's almost even better than a cookbook. It lies flat.
It does. And they've actually invented little like props that like prop them up. So
I have a stand that I got sent from Eastern Europe somewhere. This guy made it out of, it's beautiful. And it holds my little iPad safe and secure above the counter.
Oh, I've seen those. Those are cool.
Yeah.
I personally read your cookbook like a bookbook. Like I sat on the couch with a cup of coffee and...
Okay, that got me. I was like a bookbook. What the heck's a bookbook? Oh, God, a book.
Like I read it like it was a legit book. Like from front to back, like cover to cover. Like I sat down and took an afternoon and like read it. I didn't just like...
Because it rhymed, I stopped on a bookbook. I'm like, wait, you mean like an actual real book or a normal book? An average book.
I read it like it was a story.
Sorry,
book.
I had to translate that.
I read it like it was a work of fiction because
like
I was interested.
It was a work of fiction.
Yes. But
it's,
I said, but
a,
then
it's
I,
a hodgepodge.
I know, but I started on the front page and I worked my way to the back and I was making mental notes of things I wanted to cook. That's how I read this book.
Oh, excellent.
See, I was different. I mean, I went through beginning to end, but I looked at each section and then I would go back to the front and say, okay, what's the next section that I want to comment on or that I want to look at? Or then when I went and looked for vegetarian stuff, I was all through it. And I was a little more sporadic, even though I had a plan. And of course, it wasn't and literally was not until about a week ago when I was, I think it's okay to say, when we were first planning to sit down and speak, I didn't notice until probably a half an hour or so before we were actually supposed to speak the first time that we were in the acknowledgments. You could have like pushed me over with a feather and as I'm babbling right now, it was very kind. It was very, obviously it was kind, but it was very unexpected. And I couldn't believe that I didn't look at the acknowledgments, you know, a little earlier, because it's always fun to see who people thank or ask or, you know, to what lengths certain people went to get help with different things. And it's always, to me, it's kind of an adventure reading the acknowledgments of some kind of work. And I think I let out like a squeal and I was like, wait, what? Who's that? Oh my gosh, that's us. And then of course I welled up. So it was, you caused me tears and,
It caught
us by surprise.
Tears are good.
Very much appreciated.
Tears are good. Oh, good. Well, you're very much appreciated. That's why I acknowledged you. No, I really like acknowledgments too. They're quite often actually the first thing I read in a book. I flip to the back, if especially if it's nonfiction. And I mean, it kind of reads like an in joke. I tried not to make mine read like an in-joke, but sometimes they do. But there's a long list of a few names in there, but everybody's really, really important that I mentioned, including you two. I sat down with a glass of wine one night and literally wrote that all from beginning to end, those acknowledgments, and they really didn't change very much. A couple of words maybe, but that's about it. You just have to do it when you find inspiration.
And sometimes your inspiration is in a glass of wine.
Quite often a glass of wine is the foundation of my inspiration. That and a quiet walk in the woods.
Oh, yeah, that fair enough. Now, we are just so thankful that the Outlander universe brought us together.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have a really great fandom, and there's some really special people in it, including you two. We've been together a long time, the three of us.
We have been together.
Yes, we've been doing this a long time.
Well, you longer than us, but a very happy platonic threesome.
Yeah!
Well, look, I don't want to say threesome because people go to dirty places. Okay.
Our listeners always go to dirty places.
Well, that's because of you.
That's probably.
Just kidding. Okay. Other than the fact that you now have your cookbook out and also in our hands, we wanted to make sure that this interview was even more different, or different enough from our first one, that we went out a searchin'. Now, we found T. Susan Chang's article, quote, The 7 Questions of a Cookbook Reviewer, on her site called Cookbooks for Dinner, Read It and Eat It with T. Susan Chang. So I am going to use her 7 questions that she uses to rate cookbooks she has to review.
Now, don't be modest, be honest.
Well, I mean, we definitely want to hear from Teresa about maybe if you do the same thing, because you obviously have looked at a lot of cookbooks. But also,
I have in my time.
Yes. And so we're going to answer this. I mean, you may be able to tell what we're going to say. I'll read the question, or someone will read the question, and then we'll answer it. Then you can maybe say if you think this is a good question that you would put to looking at or reviewing or, deciding of whether to get a cookbook or not.
Cool. I get what you're saying. Yes, I can do that. That sounds like fun. Let's do it.
Okay. So question one.
I'm ready.
Question one, is it useful? Now, T. Susan Chang writes, this means, would an enthusiastic home cook be able to find recipes in this book that would satisfy them for a week straight of cooking, unquote. Now, off the top of my head, not even that, straight out, heck yeah. Because although, of course, anyone is welcome to get this book, if someone who is an Outlander fan is inspired to get it, they're already going to be inspired by the content and thus find at least one recipe to be able to go with.
I could get lost in this book for a month, not a week. However, it would be helpful if there was like a section that said, I want to make all of the recipes from front to back. This is what you need to get at the grocery store. So that then I could just buy all the ingredients and then lock myself in my house for a month and just cook and eat.
Wow, that sounds like my last summer writing it. Well, I'll keep that in mind for next time for a section. Or maybe an app.
Stop it.
That would be awesome if you were like, these are the recipes I want to make. And then it pops up a shopping list that says, these are the things you need to buy.
Yeah, they'd be automatically generated. Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
That sounds like it would actually be quite simple for someone who knew what they were doing.
I am not that person.
Program. No, neither am I. I can handle a WordPress blog, but that's about it.
Same here, girl.
And even then, sometimes I like find myself rolling around in a ball because I've done something wrong with Outback. Yeah, I think, is it useful is a good question for a cookbook. You know, a lot of people, cookbooks are sort of down, we're told their sales are falling because a lot of people are just looking online now. But cookbooks could be useful just to plan meals, you know what I mean? Or plan a week's worth of meals if you just sort of flip through even a cooking magazine or a cookbook. You come up with all sorts of ideas that may not even have anything to do with the recipes you just looked at. It just leads you from one thing to another. That's another way a cookbook can be useful. It doesn't just necessarily have to be a bunch of list of recipes. It can just be inspiration.
And there are some cookbooks I've come across that are so niche that, you know, they're just not going to satisfy you for more than like, okay, well, I can get one meal out of this, but I'm not like, I like a like something that is specifically just a dessert cookbook. I have use for that once a week, maybe twice a week. I mean, I'm not going to spend my week making desserts. However, something that's got everything in it, like something that like, I mean, it's got cocktails, it's got breakfast, it's got appetizers, it's got everything in it. So like I could plan a meal, like a full meal if I wanted to, for weeks with this
Yes,
book.
You could. You totally could if you wanted to go crazy and eat Outlander every single day of the week.
I do.
But hey, I did that last summer.
That's true. So you guys,
and really, it was pretty good. Even some of the early efforts where you would call the recipe a fail was still interesting enough to keep the hope alive.
Okay, question two. Is it thoughtful? And it says, this means, has the author thought of the reader's needs, hard-to-find ingredients, and guidance as to where to find them, clarifying tips in the instructions? Do the head notes help you cook the recipe? I would say that totally applies to this. For instance, I believe she shows you the difference between a dice, a mince, and a chop, which is pretty, I mean, that's like day one. But, I mean, if you've never picked up a cookbook before and you have a recipe that says mince, you know, I don't know that, and you didn't know the difference between a mince, a chop, and a dice, that's very helpful. And I think that for like hard to find ingredients, I think she tried, if there was stuff that was super hard to find, she tried to give alternatives. So, and most of it, I don't think you had a lot of super hard to find ingredients.
No, there weren't really. Now I can't even come up with one, but you know, some of the early forms of recipes had trickier ingredients in them, and like turtle soup. I mean, very few people are going to go out and buy turtle. So, for ethical reasons, for just gross reasons, for all sorts of reasons. So it is oxtail, which is actually not the easiest meat to find. It's the end tail of the ox. It's exactly what it says it is. But it provides a really, really rich base which is what you need from turtle soup. It's sort of like a little bit fishy and a little bit beefy and a little bit chickeny, which is another reason people don't want to eat it, because it's challenging. Whereas mine is just a rich beef stock, and I added a secret ingredient in there to give you a bit of a feel of turtle soup.
So, you know, I think that the hardest, if I had to say that anything in this book would be hard to find, it would probably just be like anything that's game related, like game meats.
Yeah, venison.
Yeah. Like, and
unless you have a hunter in the family,
exactly.
Then you're shaking your head at me and saying, oh, that's easy. I know, Cullen skink. It's a smoked fish soup. So traditional Cullen skink has you using smoked haddock from Scotland, which you can actually buy mail order, and it'll come to your house in a couple of days. But you can also get any smoked whitefish from locally around and make your own local Cullen skink, right? So you can turn it into a more of a locally sourced recipe. It all depends on what you want to do. It all depends if you want to sit down and have 35 people over for a big Outlander feast, in which case you may want to splurge for the real fish. If it's just dinner for you and the hubby, or for the wifey, let's not be sexist, then it could be smoked fish that your friend made for you and gave you 2 months ago, and it's been in the freezer.
I don't have any friends like that.
Oh, well, you have to live closer to me. I have a little smoker down
there. Well, I used to have a venison hookup when I lived in the South. But ooh. I just don't know any hunters here on the West Coast. Nobody here hunts.
She needs to make friends with hunters.
Clearly.
There's probably a website for that.
There's a website
for
everything.
Oh, you know there is, or there will be in the next 10 minutes.
Question 3. Is it new? Are at least a majority of the recipes really new? Now, of course, some are traditional. Some are a twist on something pre-existing. Some, I believe, are new. Well, obviously things like, I mean, people have made fudge before, but putting together, for example, the salted balls, the lavender fudge. I mean, I've heard of lavender and chocolate being, you know, paired. So it's not necessarily that the pairings are all new, but you have a good mix of traditional, updated, and new, correct?
I like to think it's a good mix. And there's a good mix of, she may also be referring to, you know, like some of those recipes are already on my blog. So about half of the recipes in the cookbook are brand spanking new and you've never seen them before. And the other half are on the blog, but a number of them have been updated or tweaked a little bit because they were written a long time ago and I had a chance to test them as time and make a few improvements.
So question 4, does it tell a story?
I mean,
I think, I don't think you can get any
I'm
more
doing
appropriate.
Well in this.
You, I know. When I found it, I thought this is so perfect. The interesting thing here is, do we think it tells a story? Yes. But you were inspired because of a story. And so, or many stories, or a very long story, however you want to look at it.
A very long story.
Yeah, so I invokes characters who are part of a very long story that most people who pick this cookbook up will be familiar with, at least to some extent, because they may have only ever read Outlander. Whatever they've read or however much they've read, it's an inspired reading of inspired content, which was inspired by an inspired, it's a little looped here, and I feel like I'm talking out of my head, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. You definitely, I mean, it's kind of almost like a silly question because does it tell a story? There's a story at every level here.
Yeah, that's very true. Yes. And a darn fine story it is.
Oh my gosh.
If you're ever going to sell a cookbook based on a story, pick a good story. And I think you did a great job.
Well, in the acknowledgements, when people get the book, if you choose to read them, you'll see that there is one to a certain individual, and I owe a lot of this to him because he told me to hook myself to a star.
Aww.
And it was a good piece of advice, and one that I'm very grateful for.
That's pretty good advice.
It's a really great piece of advice that it came at the right time. And I have to say, I picked the right star because Diane has been very generous and very supportive for almost six years now. I couldn't have picked a better plan, actually.
Question five, is it well designed? I think so. It's got a beautiful cover, so that's well designed. And thought and planning went into that. And also the layout, as you said, the acknowledgements, the foreword, the content, and also where it's put, and also how you displayed it. Quotes, the passages from the various books, and the reasons given for why such and such is named for someone, or you can see the tie-in, even if it's not said or stated out and out.
Yeah.
Wise.
Yeah. The designer did a really beautiful job putting it together. When I turned in the manuscript, it was pretty, well, it looked like the linear, looked like a, it was from a linear brain, which is what it was. It, my brain is very linear. But she's done a really, really nice job of putting, squeezing pictures in when she's had some room, and but blocking it out and having that excerpt right at the top. And you don't have the color version yet, so you haven't seen the colors. But when the different fonts are picked up with, there's a yellow and a purple and a gold, it's really, really lovely.
Question six. Is it focused? You kind of got your theme started at the beginning and stuck to it the whole way through, so I think there's definitely a focus to it, absolutely.
You're not starting off with Outlander and then going off and say, oh, you know, I really like Game of Thrones, too. I like George R.R. Martin. Or wait a second, in my childhood, I read Anne of Green Gables. I really want to talk about the native cuisine of...
Prince Edward Island?
PEI, yeah. So, although you're Canadian, so, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be so far off, but the point is, yeah, it's focused. And the cool thing about, the cool thing about basing something or being inspired by something like Diana's, like the series, is, holy smokes, I mean, the range. You don't have to rein yourself in too much. If it's anywhere next door to somewhere in the books, you can do it. Because it's either literally inspired or it's tangentially inspired, which is still inspired.
I know, but think about it. She could have, because of the breadth of these books, I mean, she has Britain, everything over in the British Isles. Mm-hmm. She has Africa. She could do the Caribbean. She can do anywhere up and down the eastern seaboard. And that gives you, like, Creole food. That gives you mountain, like, southern food, southern home cooking. You have, like, northern food. Like, you could literally make food from almost any continent and have it tie in with this book.
Totally. Totally. And, yeah, and I think, actually, well, yeah, there's no Australian representative. But
Yet.
But I'm sure you could find one. But It is pretty focused. It's based on Outlander through A Breath of Snow and Ashes, so it doesn't actually include any food in later books, and it doesn't include any of Diana's novellas, but there is lots of food in all of those books. So it was nice to be able to at least focus it down a little bit, because as you say, it's a massive world, and I can almost do whatever I want. Certainly, I can almost do as much as my sort of imagination makes me do. So there is a little bit of Caribbean food in there, Mamacita's meal of plantain and red beans and rice. And there's just lots and lots and lots of different ways and different methods of cooking. There's the fried chicken. You know, fried chicken was actually a Scottish dish, and they brought it over, and then African slaves combined it with their method of cooking, and that's sort of the birth of modern fried chicken.
Oh my goodness, now you're like rocking our world again.
There's a lot of food history is fascinating. You could never, ever, ever come to the end of all the learning there is to do.
Well, as long as people eat.
Oh, I'm giving
up. You never
know.
One day we may not. One day we may be swallowing pills, but through the day.
True. I was reading online somewhere today that was like, I'm sure it was an ad that popped up, but they were like, it's the perfect meal, and it's like a drinkable something or other, and I was like, ew. I was like, I get no enjoyment out of like drinking. I hate protein shakes. I hate any of that. I can't imagine ever not wanting to chew and swallow.
Yeah, no, I know. It's generally like lack of teeth or something that would take somebody there. I've seen a couple of weird ads for liquid nutrition on Facebook too, and I'm like, whoa, hide ad.
Yeah, exactly. Or report as spam. Report as spam. Block. Well, question seven is, and this is kind of like the best question, and kind of an entertaining question, is it the best of its kind? Quote, or at least the best I've seen. What a hard question is this to answer? She says, the answer is almost never yes, but asking it helps me sort out my thinking. If the answer is it just might be, that's a huge endorsement right there. Now, that's what the author of this article, where these questions come from, says. But for Summer and I, and looking at this question for your book, yes, we're biased, and yes, we're Outlander fans, and yes, we're Outlander Kitchen fans, and yes, this is the only thing of its kind out there, but no one else who would come up, well, we can't speak for the world for all eternity to come, but
it's You could try. Go ahead.
I could try. Okay, I'll try. It's not that other people haven't had fun coming up with stuff from the books or stuff inspired from the books, recipe-wise or cooking-wise. It's not that no one else does that or could do that. It's that, yes, you were the first to come out and at least make that relationship with Diana. And that, to me, that kind of, and then, of course, get a book contract and then, of course, now publish. So to me, yes, you're the first, but you're also, you're a fan of the story. You're a fan of Diana's. Like you said, you chose a really good star, a really genuine, giving person. Mm-hmm. To ally yourself with. And if your product, if the content that you want to put out there is related to something that you're inspired by, your love for this story and how it also came out from maybe not the easiest, but a true metamorphosis of your own life, to me, there's nothing more beautiful, because I certainly hope you go on to do a million more tremendously wonderful things, but this is icing on the cake of your life, and it's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I think I will be very, very proud of this, and this will be one of the things I'm most proud of in my life. I'm pretty certain of that. You know, there's a few other food from fiction books out there, like there's a Game of Thrones cookbook, and it's been out for a few years. There's a few others, too, and I have a copy of every one of them. Every single one of the food from fiction cookbooks that I could find, I bought, and I flipped through them late at nights and took little bits that I like from this one and little bits that I like from this one. And I'm really, really proud of this, and I think it's really, really beautiful, and so many people spent so much time putting their love and effort into it that I know it's going to be one of the crowning achievements of my life. And I'm only 46. So I'm figuring, maybe I've got one more.
You got a few more books.
Well, hopefully you have like four more.
No, but I mean, it's a really big, I would die, I'm going to knock on wood, but I would die happy knowing that my editor actually just emailed me today and the hardcovers, the final copies are off the press and there is one in the mail right now. So yeah, I'm overjoyed.
Well, now I'm thinking, since you pointed out, I'm glad you did. I'm thinking, since this represents inspired cooking or inspired dishes from Outlander through Breath of Snow and Ashes, would you do anything soon-ish, or would you wait until Diana says, okay, that's the series, and then go forward from 7 through, 10, or whatever it ends up being?
Yeah, well, that's certainly the plan. One of the reasons of cutting it off at A Breath of Snow and Ashes was that there is enough material for a second cookbook. I don't think that there's a market for an Outlander kitchen in, 2 years, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that it would be better to wait until she's finished the story and then close it off there. But that doesn't mean I can't be writing it along the way. And who knows? I mean, we'll see. Maybe people really like Outlander Kitchen and they want another cookbook. Maybe they don't. But we're about to find out.
We're finally about to find out. Hey, no, they totally will.
All the pre-sale numbers and everything are going very, very well. It's selling very, very strongly. So thank you to everybody who's pre-ordered a copy. It's looking really good.
Now, what is the official release date?
June 14th, which is a Tuesday, I believe.
Well, you can speak for what's inside this cookbook, as well as what might be in a second volume covering the rest of the big books. Have you, or would you plan on including maybe something from the Bulges as well as the big books?
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of food in the Lord John stories.
Oh, yeah. That's its own cookbook, girl.
Well, it could be its own cookbook. It could be its own e-cookbook, I would imagine, more likely. Like an Echo in the Bone. I just realized about 3 days ago, sorry, tangent, that someone has got my Moby, and I have no idea who has my copy of Moby, and it's my first edition signed by Diana, and I really hope it's my mother. I'm just going to throw that out to the universe. Because I'm looking at my bookshelf, and I've just realized again, I don't have my Moby. Oh, my God, where's my Moby? And I have no idea where it is, none whatsoever. But an Echo in the Bone, to get back to what the point I was making, you know, there's a lot of wandering around in an Echo in the Bone, and they don't make a lot of food. And the food that they make is sort of battleground stews that are pretty dire sounding. So we'll have to have lots of character-inspired things. And like you were saying, you know, pick up some things that are inspired by, which is what I've been doing for the recipes for the second season on TV, on Outlander Kitchen. I've been posting a French recipe. So it's not necessarily, doesn't have anything to do with the story, as it were, but it's just a classic French recipe that's delicious, and I would think a lot of people would like to try.
Maybe you need to have a section of survivalist stews.
Yeah.
Where they just make dire food.
You know, critter stew. You know, take your choice of squirrel, possum.
Roadkill surprise.
Roadkill. Look up in A Joy of Cooking how to skin it, and then get back to me.
Dressing your roadkill.
And you know, if you do the app idea, all you do is release the update when you have more content.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't need different apps. It's one Outlander Kitchen app.
Oh, no, of course.
And then, I mean...
But I say there's a code involved where once they buy the book, then they can upload to the app.
Yes, that's what...
You got to monetize it. You can't just give it away.
No, you can sell the app.
No one's going to buy the cow if you're giving the milk away for free.
Yeah, agreed.
That's why you buy the app.
Maybe that's for book two.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll have the app. We'll have the app ready for book two. We certainly aren't going to have it for June 14th.
No. but that's a terrific idea. That would be great. In a second volume, would you, even though it would be going back in time a little bit, would you include a section, by that time, who knows how many seasons of the show we will have had, lists of episode titles and then, or end numbers, and then the dish that, even if it's just a list, the dishes that you'd selected to go along with those?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good idea. Even if we decided to include at least some of those dishes, it would probably make sense to have a list that started with episode one and the first featured dish. That would make sense. That's a good idea. I have to jot that down.
In watching the show, has any of the food that they've created on the show inspired any recipes?
Last season, I would say there were a couple things early on in Castle Leok I was rewinding and watching slowly and trying to pick up and see what they were doing so I could, you know, pull a riff on it, make a less complicated version. This year, not so much. I mean, they're certainly sitting around the table a lot, but we don't really see the food. It's not quite as close up because it's far more intriguing to watch the Comte Saint Germain than it is to see what he's got on his spoon. So
this is true.
Yeah.
There's not as much eating this year.
No, they're sitting around the table, you know what I mean? But the food, you don't see the food. It's just a different focus because who's looking at the food? Let's admit we're all looking at the costumes. So it's just, a change, eh? And it's going to be weird in Voyager and in the backwoods. We may see more food again because there's, well, certainly in book four and five and six, there's more family sitting around the table, right? And that's when her food descriptions really hit their peak.
If we get there, I can't wait till we get to Mrs. Bug, because she was like the cook of all the cooks, her and Jenny.
Yes, I love Mrs. Bug. I totally love Mrs. Bug. She's, I think, one of two people in the cookbook that have two recipes with her name on it. Everybody else got chiseled down to one.
Well, on that delicious note, we will wrap it up a little bit and say a huge thank you for joining us and talking about your delicious, delectable cookbook that we can't wait to get back into and to cook and to read more and to cook more from, and for spending time with us tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me wax on about my cookbook in Outlander Kitchen. Again, it's been really fun.
Anytime you just, you know, again, if we get a green light, don't forget, which we, knock on wood, we will. If season 3 is announced, you know we're going to be doing a Voyager read-along. So...
Oh, yes, I know, and it's my favorite book.
So then you have to come back.
Yes. Most definitely.
Excellent. Okay, so with that, we will say again, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, dear listener, for listening. And you can find Teresa, of course, at outlanderkitchen.com. Teresa, is there anything else or any other place that people could get a hold of you besides your website?
No, that's the best place, or Facebook or Twitter, Outlander Kitchen. A quick search will find me, and you can send me an email or you can send me a tweet or whatever you want to do. I'd love to hear from you.
And we loved hearing from you. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Outlander Pod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.